Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, July 31st, 2015, during live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Iran deal, sponsored by the International and National Security Law Practice Group. We apologize for the delay, but we are getting ready to begin. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome three experts on the call to give their perspectives. The first is David B. Rivkin, Jr., who is a partner at Baker & Hostetler. The second is Professor John C. Yu, who is the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. And the third is Jamil N. Jaffer, who is the former chief counsel to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and now currently at Cybernet. Jamil, is that correctly?
George Mason University School of Law.
George Mason University School of Law. So I think without any further ado, we're going to turn it over to David Rivkin for his opening presentation.
Thank you very much, and pleasure to be with you. I'll make just a few brief points, and then we're hopefully going to have a little bit of a debate. I believe that the agreement that's been signed with Iran, actually it's technically a non-binding agreement of involving the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany plus Iran, that agreement is plagued by serious constitutional international law problems. As well as the problem that the United States committed to do more, or I should say the president committed to do more under that agreement than he has an ability to deliver on his own. To elaborate, it is certainly entirely legitimate to have executive agreements that are executed by the president, his own authority, and there have been thousands of executive agreements throughout our nation's history going back to the George Washington's administration. However, in order to comply with the framers' clear choice to divide treaty power between the president and the Senate, and also accomplish a number of other benefits, it was not just a matter of cabining president's power. If you look at their original era founding documents, you will see that the framers were concerned that all major international undertakings by the United States should enjoy broad domestic support, in part because of experience during the Articles of Confederation, where states in particular were not very compliant with agreements. And also because, of course, treaties are a supreme law of the land, give states an opportunity for their membership in the Senate to have a voice in how those are brought about. So to preserve the viability of the treaty clause, major international undertakings by the United States have always been traditionally, there are some exceptions which I expect to hear in a few minutes, but have always been done by treaties. With one exception, arms control arrangements have always been done by treaties. And we're talking here about a deal that involves arms control arrangements, billions of dollars worth of frozen funds being released, lifting of major sanctions, an issue that has been at the heart of American foreign policy, probably going back some 40 years, although the Iranian nuclear program does not go that long. But this is not just a nuclear deal because it rearranges a number of other arrangements with Iran. So that deal should have been done by treaty. Instead, it was done by an executive agreement. Of course, the administration's position is that it is, quote, a voluntary executive agreement that does not impose binding obligations on the United States. I do not think it's true. We can talk about it some more, but if you look carefully at the agreement, there's one provision there that refers to the fact, it's an introduction to Article 1, that the parties will take voluntary measures, but numerous additional agreements, numerous additional provisions envision mandatory, contain mandatory language. Plus, this administration has had this agreement endorsed, quote-unquote, by Security Council resolution executed under Chapter 7. I know some of my good friends have argued that the word endorse does not convey the same mandatory force as the word decide, and again, we can talk about it. So, to make long story short, we have an administration that has basically entered into a major international undertaking about any effort to proceed with a treaty route and made it mandatory to boot, both, I would argue, with regard to the treaty, the agreement itself, as well as what they've done with the Security Council. The second problem is that the president has made commitments to lift most of existing sanctions. Now, that requires a serious analysis of the waiver language, which is quite broad in the existing sanction statutes. But I would argue that he cannot lift all of the sanctions that he promised to lift, and therefore has created a difficult situation for us. He'll probably lift them in any case, but that would not be a faithful interpretation of a statutory language, in part because the various sanctions have been imposed on Iran, not only because of its nuclear program, but also because of its support for terrorism, its money laundering, and ballistic missile programs. And I don't think even this administration would argue that that those issues have been resolved or even addressed by this deal. And my final point here is that because of the way in which the deal was arrived at, despite the existing Supreme Court case law that has provided for a preemptive force cases like preemptive force of both executive agreements and federal statutes, and two leading cases being Crosby and Garamendi. In this instance, the states would be able to impose sanctions of their own, not as extensive as at the federal level, but substantial sanctions. And that is largely the case because the sort of the most robust of existing sanctions, the 2010 statute called Comprehensive Iran Sanctions Accountability and Divestment Act, CISADA specifically authorizes states to impose, in effect, sanctions that would feature divestment by their pension funds from companies engaging in certain investment activities in Iran, and enables them to debar those companies from participating in public procurement. And even a very capacious use of the waiver language in CISADA and other statutes does not negate this authorization. I'll stop for now.
All right, Professor Yu, go ahead.
I think it's a hard question whether this is a treaty or an executive agreement. I have to say, when I look at it, I think it falls on the side of a non-treaty. As David has said, and I think as everybody who has worked in this field for many years, as he has and I has and have and Shamil has, that we recognize that even though the Constitution only talks about the treaty clause, which of course requires the Senate to consent to treaties by two-thirds, there are agreements that the federal government makes that aren't treaties, sole executive agreements, congressional executive agreements. Supreme Court has never decided where the line is between one and the other, and the federal government has engaged in a lot of both, but nowadays sole executive agreements and congressional agreements swamp treaties in terms of their numbers. So the question is this agreement more like the treaties that we've seen in the past or otherwise? Now, before I go down the route, let me say I think the agreement itself is a terrible idea in terms of policy. I think it's the idea of the United States and the allies releasing $150 billion in assets, lifting sanctions in the hopes that Iran will not build a nuclear weapon for 10 years in the future, given Iran's conduct over the last, since the Iranian Revolution, I think is foolish. But unfortunately, that doesn't have to do with whether I think the agreement itself is constitutional or legal. So in my mind, when you look at the practice, I think that this agreement does fall on the side of non-treaties. And the reason for that are two. Even though I think David is right, every arms control agreement that the United States has done, with the side of the interim SALT agreements, which were not intended to be permanent, have all been done as treaties. The problem is that this doesn't call on the United States to do anything in the arms control area. It's all on all the obligations in terms of arms control are on the Iranian side. On the our side, the main obligation is lifting sanctions. And that is a power that really lies in the hands of Congress. Right? The only reason that President Obama can lift sanctions is because when Congress passed the Comprehensive Iran Sanctions Act back in 2010, it gave President Obama the ability to waive sanctions, which would otherwise have been mandatory. And to me, that means that this is a power that lies within the hands of Congress's power over international commerce, and so therefore is more like a congressional executive agreement like the WTO, NAFTA, the forthcoming Trans-Pacific Partnership agreements, which have all been done as statutes and not as treaties. So that's one reason why I think this, on this close question, unfortunately, I think it falls on the side of a congressional exec agreement or a sole exec agreement, not a treaty. The second reason is I think Republicans in the Congress have only themselves to blame on all this, because suppose the agreement had been proposed by President Obama in its current form, but Congress had never passed the Corker Amendment. Then I think the agreement might be on much shakier constitutional grounds. I think David's arguments could be brought forward in court, and there could be some measure of success, depending. As I said, the Supreme Court's never decided this issue. But Congress passed a law, right, this Corker Amendment, before it even saw the deal, saying that it basically approves the deal and has a chance to either approve or disapprove. But if it disapproved, President Obama could veto it, and that the Congress would then have to pass a two-thirds override to disapprove the agreement. I find that Jim Elliott will know more about this since he was most recently in the Senate. I find it hard to see President Obama not being able to build the blocking minority vote minority that he needs in one of the two houses. If that's the case, then suppose that goes to the Supreme Court. Then under Youngstown Sheet and Tube, I'm afraid this is a case where, and this is not my favorite case in the world, Youngstown Sheet and Tube. But anyway, the concurring opinion by Justice Jackson, which has been adopted into the majority reasoning of cases like the Iran hostages deal and death penalty cases. The Supreme Court has said when the President and Congress agree in foreign affairs, the courts are generally going to be deferential because the President is acting at the maximum of his constitutional powers. And so this is a case where Congress, I think, helped dig its own hole here because it pre-approved the deal and then created this regime where it's very unlikely that it's going to be able to stop it. So I think there's two other interesting questions that David raised. I mean, one is the international law aspect of it. I think there are important arguments to figure out about whether the agreement is in some sense binding as a matter of international law. The Obama administration might have had more of a claim that it wasn't binding, but then they had it submitted to the UN Security Council, and the Security Council essentially blessed the deal. It's called for the lifting of the sanctions, which opposed. Actually, ironically, it seems to me there's a problem here. The Security Council is approving the violation of past Security Council resolutions by Iran. But in any event, once the Security Council has blessed it, I think there's a nice question about whether this is an international law obligation. I'm not sure whether that affects whether it's a treaty versus a congressional or sole executive agreement, because in my mind, that's not based on the binding nature under international law of the obligations on the U.S. In any event, it seems to me most of the obligations are really on Iran's side. The last question is the ability of sanctions. So I actually was looking, and Jamil again could maybe speak to this. I think he might have been working in the Senate at the time the bill was passed. But in the 2010 Iran deal, I think it's a lot easier legal question than it might otherwise be. If states have passed sanctions laws on Iran themselves, which they have, and the Obama administration tried to walk into court and say, we have this sole executive agreement that overrides, preempts these state laws, then under these old cases, Belmont and Pink from the 1930s, sole executive agreements can preempt state law. But in the 2010 Iran sanctions bill, there's a provision that says that state laws that sanction Iran are not to be preempted by federal law. And so actually Congress, luckily back then, you know, in 2010, actually blessed state sanctions laws on Iran. So I don't think any of those state deals, you know, I'm sure Obama administration will go to court anyway, but I think that that provision is, it can't be waived by President Obama, which is why I think the deal, when you look at it, it doesn't say that the federal government will order states to drop sanctions. It, it says something like they're going to try to persuade or encourage state officials to lift the sanctions, because I think the Obama administration realizes they don't have the legal authority to do that. So unfortunately, my bottom line is, unfortunately, I think no matter how bad policy this is, and I think it is a terrible policy, this deal, and it would have been better, I think, if Congress had never approved it, pre-approved it, or blessed it afterwards, and then the next president can just terminate it on day one. Unfortunately, I think Congress, by passing the Corker Amendment, has actually blessed the deal before it was even presented in public.
All right.
I'm done.
Well, I guess it's my turn. So this is Jamil Jaffer. So I'll take on a couple of things that have been sort of said right at the outset. I think, first of all, on the question of, is this a treaty or is this an executive agreement, you know, to me, it, at the end of the day, as a practical matter, it doesn't really matter, because there would have been no way to enforce that question. If they had done it as an executive agreement, Congress had done nothing. John says, look, you could go to the courts, but the reality is this is a classic political question. This is a classic case where it's hard to imagine any party who would have had standing to bring a suit. Congress saying we were cut out of the treaty process, I mean, you know, that legislative standing is, you know, not, hardly existent. And so the notion that somebody would have the ability to challenge the president's execution of this agreement as an executive agreement is not reality. And so as a result, Congress was faced with a situation here recently where, knowing the president was going to do this deal, and knowing the president had been given by Congress the authority to waive the very sanctions it had put in place, the very sanctions that brought Iran to the table, it's Congress's fault, to be sure, but not because of the Corker-Cardin legislation. Rather, it's Congress's fault because Congress gave the president a broad national security waiver, never intended for it to be used this way, and never thought it would. And frankly, I think the president, I think David and John are both right, the president's going beyond his authority in using waivers in this way. But Congress has a remedy to that. They can take those waivers away. And the problem was there just aren't 60 votes in the Senate or a veto-proof majority in the House to take away the president's waiver authority. And as a result, Congress was faced with a Hobson's choice. Do you do nothing and allow the president to make the deal and execute on it using the waivers you gave him as a matter of statute, or do you try to put in place some legislation that would force a review, force a vote, and move the ball down the road something to at least take away some of the political benefit of the agreement? And because what's likely to happen in this scenario is, under Corker-Cardin, because there's a mandatory review period, the president has not been able to waive sanctions and won't for the entire 60-day review period. And as a result, there's a chance for us to all look at the deal, talk about it, debate it as we are here, before he begins implementing it. Had we not put Corker-Cardin in place, the president would have been executing the deal now. The waivers would be in place, and we'd be rolling down the road. And so so Congress acted, took away the president's waiver for 60 days, and now is a chance to vote. Now, it's true, it's going to be hard to muster a veto-proof majority in both houses. I actually think there's an outside shot at that. But even if you don't, imagine this. If there is a majority in both houses to vote against this deal, that takes away a significant amount of political cachet this deal has today and makes it that much easier for the next president to unwind it. And in fact, in my view, if that is what happens, which I think is what is likely to happen, if not a veto-proof majority, certainly a majority in both houses, it's highly likely that that companies in Europe and other parts of the world are likely to tread very lightly in the next year before the presidential election happens in getting into bed with Iran. And the reason why is simple. If there's a significant likelihood, given the political majorities in both houses rejecting the deal, even though it may not be veto-proof, it's highly likely that the next president, if it's a Republican, will probably take steps to reverse the deal. Now, I know there's a debate about should reverse on day one, should not reverse on day one. I put myself with John in that camp. I say absolutely reverse on day one, use your executive authority, reimpose sanctions. I know David has a different view, and we should talk a little bit about that. But the thing that gives you the ability to to undermine the deal right at the outset is the fact that there's not sanctions being waived immediately, that we've got a 60-day review period to debate it, to show all the horrific flaws in the agreement, and for Congress to put itself on record. And by the way, it means the president then owns this agreement, and those who vote with this agreement own this agreement. And that itself is a political benefit and a political cost that is immeasurable. And so this whole notion that somehow Congress pre-approved the deal, that's just not true. There's no pre-approval. In fact, to the contrary, Congress took away the president's waiver authority and showed skepticism about the deal for 60 days. If Congress had pre-approved the deal, they would have just let it happen and let the president use his statutory waivers. That's pre-approval. Doing nothing is pre-approval. And so given the unenforceability of the treaty clause, the realistic unenforceability, it's never been enforced in a court by Congress or anyone else. And so I think that's sort of, I think, what was motivating Congress to act when it did. It's true that that it acted by huge majorities, 98-1 in the Senate, 425 in the House. But that's emblematic of the fact that because of the significant pressure that Republicans in the House and Senate put on the president, he ultimately collapsed at the last minute, at the 11th hour before the Foreign Relations Committee acted, 18-0, and ultimately pulled down his veto threat that he'd been threatening for months. And so that's my take on it. But let's open up for questions.
Can I maybe have a very brief rejoinder?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I agree with some of Jamil's points and disagree with others, and the same is true with probably you. First, not to belabor the treaty versus non-treaty point, but I would say this. I wasn't trying to say that there's something magical about arms control agreements that limit the number of ballistic missile launchers or bombers or intermediate range missiles. Basically, major undertakings by the United States that involve enormously important commitments have to be done by a treaty if a treaty power is to have any sense, if it's not to just wither with the mind. And I don't think anybody can seriously disagree that the combination of what, because yes, we have not made any changes to our nuclear forces, but we put a great deal on the table. We legitimated, in effect, Iran, which has been an outlaw regime. We legitimated Iran's nuclear infrastructure. We legitimated, by proceeding despite this, Iran's miscreant behavior in the region. We're going to give them $150, $160 billion. I use the same argument that was used successfully, at least up until the time the chief rewrote the statutory language in the NFIB case, which is, if this is, therefore it was about the Commerce Clause, and the argument was, if individual insurance purchase mandate is supported by the Commerce Clause, tell me something that it isn't. I would use the same argument here. If this can be done through an executive agreement, then everything can be done through an executive agreement, and the treaty power is moribund, and that is a serious violation of structural separation of powers with both horizontal and vertical implications. Now, I agree with John in part. I think the Corker-Menendez is an abominable deal of respect, Jamil. The fact that you stopped the president for 60 days is not worth the symbol. By the way, I don't think it's a pre-authorization, in part, and I agree on this with Jamil, because the Corker-Cardin or Corker-Menendez doesn't even purport to authorize the agreement as a whole. It only talks about sanctions. So I don't think it pre-authorizes anything, but it certainly muddies the waters, and it certainly creates a situation where Congress, particularly the Senate, who should be standing, whether it's, again, we can debate PQD. I actually think that it's probably most likely PQD. I'm not as pessimistic about legislative standing, just as the House is suing the Obama administration on its rewriting of Obamacare. I think the Senate, if it wanted to, could have sought and probably at least a good chance of gaining legislative standing. But the worst part here is that we have at least a symbolic blessing of the utterly unconstitutional behavior by the president. Let me stop here.
I just wanted to react a little bit to both points. This is John Yu, by the way, before we go to questions. One with David. I totally agree with David that the treaty clause should be at least reserved for politically important agreements and not temporary agreements. So I just think – I actually believe quite strongly that actually arms control agreements should be ones that have to be done by the treaty clause. And, of course, politically important ones like NATO, the UN treaty, you know, significant political alliances. The thing about this treaty is that really, this agreement is that it doesn't really limit the U.S.'s freedom of action that much. So if it had actually said that the United States promised not to attack Iran during the pendency of the agreement, you know, if it was a sort of like a non-aggression promise, I would have thought that would definitely be a treaty. The thing is that when you look at this agreement, and I think this is why they did it this way, they were trying to skirt just beyond the outskirts. When I say they, I mean the Obama administration, just trying to skirt the outer boundaries of what is a treaty. They constructed it so that the obligations in terms of political and military lie on Iran's side. Iran's the ones that's taking on the arms control obligations. On our side, it's really just the dropping of sanctions, which is something that Congress is primarily in charge of, and it was Congress's fault to give the president the waiver power that it did in the sanctions deal. With Jamil's point, I totally accept Jamil's points about the politics of this, that the Corker Amendment had a lot of important benefits, which I don't gainsay at all. I think it is very valuable to put everybody on the record, and that it does delay immediate implementation of the agreement. But I think the price for that is that it made the agreement much more secure as a constitutional matter, as a legal matter. Now, I actually happen to believe that the president could terminate a treaty as well as a executive agreement without congressional participation. So, you know, the next president could terminate this either way, whether it's done by a treaty or executive agreement. But some people, quite a number of people, don't think that. And so I think there is a loss there. But I do think Jamil's right that you know, this agreement, and if you see higher numbers opposing it when it comes up for a vote, it's going to undermine business confidence, investor confidence in doing deals with Iran. I don't know whether that would have been affected one way or another by whether it was done as a treaty or a sole executive agreement. Last point is on standing. I think this is an interesting question. I was actually thinking there might be people who could bring a lawsuit. You know, probably the closest case to this would be Goldwater versus Carter, where Senator Goldwater tried to sue to stop President Carter from unilaterally terminating the alliance with the treaty with Taiwan. I could see standing if a senator wanted to bring suit and say that this essentially took power away from him, from being able to vote on the right that on a treaty. You know, as you know, Goldwater versus Carter, the justices split on these questions about standing, ripeness, political question, mootness. On the other hand, there might be other people who could bring suit. You know, perhaps people who've been harmed by Iranian-sponsored terrorism might have sufficient standing. Perhaps business competitors of businesses that are now going to benefit by being able to go into Iran might have standing. It's not clear to me, but I think that there might have been a possibility. And I think once you have Congress and the president in agreement, even if you could find standing, there's very little chance such a case could succeed now.
Just 10 seconds. John and I are in stronger court on this. I do think the strongest case for standing would have been the Senate acting as an institution, which is the way the House did it. But we don't have to debate this, no.
I'll jump in for 2 seconds and we'll go to questions. You know, look, I mean, it's all really interesting. There might be a possibility of potentially having standing. There might be a possibility that you could win and and force the president to do it by treaty. Might's interesting, right? It's really interesting as an academic matter, you know, for writing law review articles or writing op-eds. But, you know, in practical reality, Congress has never succeeded, not in 200 years, succeeded in defeating the president's ability to enter into an executive agreement, even when they've disputed it many, many times. This is not the first controversial executive agreement or purported executive agreement. I agree that there are arguments, good arguments on both sides about whether this is an executive agreement or a treaty, but none of that matters. It's all really interesting as a matter of academic debate, but in real life, in the Senate, in the House, in the political sphere, and most importantly, in the foreign policy sphere between the U.S. and Iran, none of that matters, because by the time It would have worked its way through the courts, and it would have – I mean, the odds are small that it would not – that it would have survived on standing, would have survived on political question, and that we would have won, and that it would have been enforced. The president could enter into this by treaty. By the time all that happened, we'd be 5 years down the road, 3 years down the road. This deal would have been implemented. Sanctions would have been lifted. The game would have been over. Instead, what you have here, Congress has acted. Congress has stopped the president, albeit temporarily, and Congress is going to undermine – every political benefit of this deal by voting by majorities of both houses, something that would never have happened. And by the way, didn't happen with the Bush sofa when the Democrats were upset about the Iraq sofa. Didn't happen before, but you know, in any other treaty, you know, where or any other agreement where Congress thought it ought to be a treaty, they've never been successful at undermining it, either through the courts or politically. Here you're actually going to get a vote, and it's going to be politically undermined. That's a win, and we ought not discount that.
All right. Well, thanks to all three of our experts for great opening presentations and a discussion here. Let's move on to questions from the audience. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, to ask a question, press star and the pound key. And we do have over 100 people on the call. And just under 25 minutes. So we had our first, as expected, we had our first questions jump on right away. So we'll go to them.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I think it might be worthwhile for the participants to devote a little bit of attention to the fundamentals of international law for the benefit of people who are not specialists in that field. Strictly speaking, it is a field and not there's no such thing as an international law, because the ancient legal maxim is that there is no law without a sovereign, and therefore there can be no sovereign over sovereign nations, and therefore no law over sovereign nations. The only thing that is being discussed here is persuasion or moral force or opinion or whatever, but there is no actual law, and when people speak of international obligations, they are generally not enforceable in most countries, certainly not in this one. So we're basically talking about people trying to persuade one another. It's all a political process. And we do have to consider also, as of course as some of the arguments made on the others in favor of this so-called agreement, that is to try to avoid us having to go to war. Well, we need to ask whether, in fact, if we fail to ratify it, we are committing ourselves to go to war. And if we're ready for that, if the agreement went forward, would it buy us maybe 3-4 years? Certainly it's not going to buy us 10. And do we know how to make use of the time during that 3 or 4 years to perhaps develop some bunker-busting weapon that could take out the Fordo facility, which we don't seem to have now?
Well, let me just say briefly, I wouldn't take a backseat to anybody in my robust defense of our sovereignty or anybody else's sovereignty, but with respect, you're wrong. The framers understood very clearly that international law matters, not in its current permutation, but at least in the core issues of war and peace. They wanted to maintain the respect of decent opinions of mankind. They wanted to take our international obligations seriously. That's the whole reason for the treaty route. Treaty, and I don't want to get into a debate about self-executing versus not self-executing, but the treaties are the supreme law of the land. They certainly trump state law. Executive agreements also potentially trump state law. So we cannot just sweep it off the table and say it doesn't matter. Moreover, since we're being practical here and not just talking about law, it matters enormously that the United States, in the eyes of all of our allies, the rest of the world, has committed itself to do a number of things beyond just lifting sanctions. I cannot help myself. This is where John and I agree in the legal framework, but disagree in the facts. This deal is de facto a non-aggression pact, because if you look carefully at 100-plus pages of this agreement, we clearly are saying there is a mechanism for, look, the only reasonable casus belli for us would have been the Iranian nuclear program. In this agreement, we have consented to the Iranian nuclear program continuing along certain parameters. And to the extent we feel the Iranians are cheating, there's a very laborious genteel verification process. Yes, as a technical matter, the next president can certainly order to launch military operations against Iran. That would be quite successful. We would not need, by the way, any bunker busting munitions. We can service the entire Iranian nuclear target array with existing conventional weapons. That's not a problem. But it would be viewed as a huge lawbreaker. We would pay an enormous price for it, which is why it cannot be done easily or quickly. So international law matters a great deal, and this president has mousetrapped his successor into a kind of mess where it would have the same impact on the next, hopefully, Republican administration as what Jimmy Carter has done vis-a-vis Iran and Nicaragua, dominated the first, most of a Reagan first term.
Well, I completely disagree with David on that front. I think actually that that Congress voting on this deal and voting against the deal, which it will in both houses, actually demonstrates to the world, to the P5+1 and to Iran, that this deal does not have the 100% support of the United States. In fact, the president alone is making this deal, and that when the next president comes in, that's very possible that he will reverse it. And so I think actually to the contrary. Now, as a matter of violating international law and the like, the reality here is this is a UN resolution that implements a deal the president has signed, not a deal that Congress has signed off on, not a deal that the American political establishment agrees with. In fact, the everyone knows, the entire world knows, the entire world is waiting to see what Congress does because they know that Congress doesn't support this deal. And so the notion somehow that the U.S. would be bound, it would be so much harder to reverse it because he's gotten this UN resolution, I completely reject that. And it's interesting that the UN has acted. It's interesting that the U.S. might be viewed as a lawbreaker. But I think actually by saying that out loud and suggesting that, we're playing into that very notion that the administration is trying to create. I think to the contrary, the reality is that UN resolution only exists because the president has asserted he has the authority to make this deal. And Congress has said, no, you're going to wait and we're going to act. And if you do it without us, the next president may very well reverse it. And we're showing you there's a political majority for that viewpoint.
I guess I think on the international law point, one thing to also emphasize is that for the sanctions to succeed, you need comprehensive support because it's like water in a dam. If there's a hole, then all the water is going to pour through that hole. And if we don't have this cooperation of other major economies in the world on sanctions, then no matter what our sanctions law is going to be, is going to be futile if the Europeans or Russia and China are fully trading with Iran. And I think that's where international law has its real practical application because regardless of what we think of international law in the United States, one way or the other, and just whether there are varying levels of how much compliance various people think there should be with international law in our country, many of our allies deeply believe that, not just believe, have written into their constitutions, I have to point out Germany and Italy and Japan in particular, where international law in their constitutions is placed above the acts of their parliaments and legal authority. They will not participate in sanctions regimes with us unless there's international law authority for it. And so I think that I think David at some level is right that we need to have international law on our side, even if you agree with the original question's view that it's not really law because this is the Austinian system. There's not really law because there's no real enforcement to it. Even if you believe in that, other countries are allies. Act because they think there is something called international law. That said, I agree with Jamil that I'm very critical of the Obama administration for going to the UN Security Council first before Congress could even vote on the act. But I don't think that international law can dictate how our political branches decide on whether they're going to live up to the obligation or not. So even though there is a UN Security Council resolution now, even though there are going to be people going to argue that Security Council resolution becomes somehow internally binding on us as a law because we signed the UN Charter as a treaty. The Supreme Court has said, though, that the decisions of these international organizations do not override the constitutional powers of our branches. And so the President and the Congress, they still have full freedom to ignore or refuse or contradict any Security Council resolution under our own domestic law. We might be in violation under international law, but that doesn't affect how we should decide whether to do this as a treaty or sole executive agreement.
All right. Well, we have two more questions pending at this time and about a little under 14 minutes to go. So we'll get both those questions, hopefully get both those questions in and maybe a couple more. So again, star and then the pound key.
As far as the potential actions of the next president, in addition to Goldwater's challenge of Carter, Bush also withdrew from the ABM treaty. And so while this doesn't rise to the level of a treaty, there are those examples, even though for Bush, again, there was senatorial opposition and the lawsuit filed. But my question is, Andy McCarthy has written extensively on this, and in addition to advising Congress use power of the purse and appointment power, and I think Senator Cruz has a bill to that effect, he talks about a congressional tracking resolution that would affirmatively state that Congress is announcing that if the president doesn't recognize that this qualifies as something that should be a treaty, that it should minimally be approved, something that's consequential should be approved congressionally. So is there precedent for a congressional tracking resolution on this order? And this would likely gain more Democrats than as far as affirming their own power and setting this for the record as being something that could be expected by any future executive. But is there precedent for this, and would it be effective?
Well, I'm not aware of any precedent, but it sort of doesn't. It would be totally ineffectual, right? I mean, what it would make no difference. Andy's got a lot of interesting thoughts on this. I've read with a lot of interest Andy's articles on this area. The problem is all of the things that Andy suggests that have actual teeth to them. And note, Corker Cardin, you may not like its teeth. Its teeth may be soft in a lot of people's view, but it has some teeth. It's taken away the president's power to act temporarily, and could take away his power away permanently if enough people vote to disapprove. But all the things that Andy suggests, like, you know, well, it's forced to be a treaty using the power of the person, that actually might be effective, because then it's a power versus another power, and that might actually work. And you know, in fact, then Senator Clinton, then Senator Kerry, a number of Democratic senators actually tried to do that very same thing with President Bush's SOFA with Iraq. It went nowhere. But again, here there just aren't the votes in Congress to pass something like that. If we had the votes, We would have done it, but Congress would have done it. That would have been a winner. The votes just aren't there, and that just wasn't a practical reality. Just like the votes weren't there to take away the president's power to implement this immediately prior to the deal being struck. And so, the tracking resolution, again, interesting idea, but no teeth to it. A lot of these congressional resolutions at the end of the day, what they are is they're strongly worded letters from the Senate or the House or both. They have no effect. And so while I think it's interesting that people always, you know, tout these resolutions they do, they really have no impact. The legislation, you know, putting laws into effect, like Corker Cardin, you may not like it, but it's a law, and it has the force of law, unlike these resolutions. They're interesting, but they don't do anything.
A couple of points. All three of us, I think, agree that the next president, as a matter of constitutional domestic law, can terminate obligations. The case which John referred to, of course, is Medellin, and it is indeed true that the decisions by international tribunals, even if conducted pursuant to a treaty, do not alter the constitutional realities with Bill of Rights or separation of powers. So, and I happen to think that the president can terminate a treaty in part because the domestic force of a treaty stems entirely, despite the Senate participation, which is a procedural matter, stems entirely from existing international obligations. So since the president can renounce the international obligations, domestic obligations die with that. But the problem which we have again, and this is what Jimmy and I disagree, is what is more important? Create the mechanism like in Corker Menendez or Corker Cardin and give a sort of a political cover and an opportunity for a number of members to vote against this and hold the president up for 60 years. But in the process, to dilute, devalue the treaty route, this administration and frankly and some of the previous administrations have not used as they properly should have. And I think the damage it does to our constitutional fabric far outweighs the benefits of Corker Cardin. So it's a nuanced disagreement about, you know, what are the pluses and minuses here. But look, nobody denies that the next president will be able to announce this. We're going to pay a hell of a price for it. We have to do it very carefully. And in my opinion, it's going to take it's not going to be the first day, it's not going to be the first month, it may not even be in the first year, because we have to build enough of a support and an explanation for what we're doing. Because John is right, we unfortunately cannot have effective sanctions or any kind of effective foreign policy without support, at least from our key allies.
One last thing about the Corker Amendment. I do take the political aspect of it that forces a vote, but I'm not sure whether that was worth what the deal was, because yes, you do create this process where people will have to vote on the bill, and you had the temporary suspension of any possible waiver for the 60-day period. But if there had never been a Corker, again, suppose there had never been a Corker amendment, so President Obama lifts the waivers, Congress still could have voted on whether to override or terminate the international agreement, the sole executive agreement, one way or the other, just by introducing the bill. Right? They could have just introduced the bill on the sanctions legislation. They could have, to say we actually override the waiver, or we just impose mandatory sanctions, or to pass a law disapproving the agreement. The Republicans who control both the House and the Senate, they could easily have scheduled and put the bill forward. You would have still had the supporters of the administration have to go on the record one way or the other. So I don't see why the Corker Amendment was really necessary to produce those votes. And the problem is, David says, in exchange, I don't think that necessarily the problem is that it undermines the treaty clause, which has been eroded anyway. But even short of that, what you have done is that you have put this whole deal into Youngstown Category 1 now. And if there had never been a category, if there had never been a Corker Amendment, it would have been in categories where two or three, which would have been much harder for a president to defend constitutionally.
But that's just not true. It's in that category. If Congress agrees, if Congress endorses the deal, they haven't endorsed the deal. They're going to vote against the deal. Majorities in both houses are going to vote against the deal. They won't have a veto-proof majority to override the deal. But they'll vote against the deal. That is affirmatively not of Youngstown. That's just not true.
But then
now,
doesn't the legislation gives its right? I understand the way the Corker Amendment works, that people vote against it, but the president can veto the disapproval. And then if you don't get that override, then
that's
what's
not
happened?
Approval. That's not Youngstown Category 1. To the contrary. That's just not. The problem is Congress has already given the president authority to waive. Right?
Jamil, can I just say one thing?
New waiver authority.
We're not having an oral argument here, but let me just try to put it very crisply. Without Corker Cardin, Article 1 could have said that what the president has done is entirely unlawful, entirely illegitimate, because he eschewed the treaty clause. Let me finish. By doing Corker Cardin, you've created an argument, which, by the way, John, you is using quite ably, that in effect,
for which Congress, intellectually wholly disagree with, but this is why a court would do it.
right. The argument would be this.
In
exchange for those practical benefits that you're talking about, the 60 days, opportunity to vote, Congress at least implicitly acquiesced to an unconstitutional action by Article 2.
Yeah.
That's the symbolism I'm talking about. That's how it's going to be construed.
But that's, but fine, David.
I'm afraid
so,
I agree.
But the problem with your argument is your whole position rests on symbolism itself. We'll symbolically say, oh, the president violated the Constitution by entering this agreement. It doesn't matter. The Congress gave him statutory authority to waive, which he will use and point to. So we have all the symbolism. And you and I and Andy can write great articles in National Review castigating the president for acting unconstitutionally, just like we did with Obamacare, just like we do with all sorts of other things. And you know what? It matters none. He would have implemented the sanctions relief using statutory authority that we gave him, and he would have gone down the road. This deal would have been in place, and none of it would have mattered. It would have all been really interesting academic discourse, but it wouldn't have mattered. Here,
no, I disagree with. I think you're going too far with that, because I think that the only benefit you got out of, and I'm not saying you, I don't know why I keep saying the only benefit Congress gets for the Corker-Card Amendment is practically the temporary suspension of the waivers for 60 days. The vote totals to override under Corker-Carter are the same vote totals you would have needed just to put mandatory sanctions
right
into place anyway. So the only
thing that
happened was that he got a 60-day limit on, but then he'll just put them into effect anyway.
There are two reasons why that matters, John.
Every major separation of powers case, Noel Canning being one of the more recent, the court looks at the acquiescence of the two branches. Let me be very clear what the Corker-Card does. It allows the president to present to Congress an unconstitutional product. It should have been done as a treaty. He's presenting it as a quasi-executive agreement. And Congress deigns to vote on one issue to try to block his waiver of sanctions. I care about Israel. I care about sanctions. I care about nuclear Iran. But I care about the Constitution first and foremost. You have just acquiesced. Article 1 has just acquiesced an utterly unlawful behavior, enabling the next president to say, well, if I can really jack people up politically, maybe I'll get the same deal. It is that symbolism that cannot be erased by 60 days or any other practical benefits. And the courts look at this stuff.
The courts were going to look at this anyways, and they weren't going to do anything about it because there would have been no standing. The deal would have been in place for 3 years. It would have been long over and done with had nothing happened here. And at the end of the day, this notion that Congress could have acted, the reality is that Congress could have acted. That's true, but Congress wouldn't have acted because it's much easier politically to not do anything. Just like Congress didn't do anything on the sofa, just like Congress didn't do anything about President Reagan's deal on Iran hostages, Congress is better. It feels better about not acting. Here, you put all the members of Congress on record saying we are going to vote on this deal. And had they voted, by the way, had Republicans forced a vote without the prior Corker-Card legislation, Democrats, the president would have pointed and said, look, this is political hackery. Congress is now voting to attack a deal that we got done, that the P5 plus 1 agreed to. It's political hackery. Here, they can't do that. Here, they can't do that because 98-1 in the Senate and 425 in the House, Congress said, we're going to weigh in. So that's what it took away. It took away that political hackery. It also took away the president saying, look, the deal's already being implemented. It's been 60 days. We've already implemented the deal. So those two things are now off the table as a result of this legislation, and that's why it matters. And those practical realities, there was no enforcement mechanism, David. It's interesting, but there's no enforcement mechanism.
Well, this is Christian Corgan. We unfortunately don't have any more time for questions, but if anyone else wants to give any concluding thoughts, we have about a minute left.
All I would say is we're talking about the same issue. We're talking about precedent. We're talking about symbolism. We just balance the equities differently. As I say, I am greatly troubled by an implicit Senate acquiescence that because of a practical, and particularly the Senate, because it is there, it is in Article 2, Section 2, it is their core authority. They have given it up. If I were talking gently to every senator they ever voted for, I would say you're setting a terrible institutional precedent. You've been mauled. You've been raped by this president by not proceeding with a treaty route, and you dignified it by giving him an alternative. This is a very bad precedent. Now, I understand Jamil does not see it this way, but I want to make sure that at least we understand the full range of symbolic and practical consequences of this. That's all.
Well, 98 senators disagree.
My one brief closing thing is this just shows how important the November election is, because I think Congress is not going to stop the deal at this point with the way the I think the amendment works and what President Obama has on his side now constitutionally, but I think we probably all agree that the next president has the constitutional authority to terminate the deal, and that's going to be one of the big issues at stake in November.
Well, this is Christian Corgan. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank David Rifkin, John Yu, and Jamil Jaffer for being with us. It's a very spirited discussion and a great discussion of very important issues. Just a reminder that if you want to re-listen to the call or if you missed any part of it, a podcast of this will be available on our website at fedsoc.org early next week. And you can find that this podcast as well as all of our previous Teleforum conference calls. So until next time, thank you all for joining us, and we look forward to our next Teleforum conference call. So thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.